Welcome to EB5 Investment Voice, where attorney insights intersects with immigration investments. If you are a foreign investor, domestic fund manager, or enterprising entrepreneur and want to get the most out of the EB5 program, you have come to the right place. I'm Mark Deal, and I'll be your co-host on this journey. I'm joined by your host, Mona Shaw, and other attorneys at Mona Shaw & Associates, as well as immigration leaders from around the world. So let's get into EB5 Investment Voice.
Mona Shaw, welcome to 2019.
Thanks, Mark. It's been quite an eventful year, and we're still not even halfway through January.
Oh my gosh, it has. I know there's a lot of stuff going on right now. In fact, we're not going to talk about that because at the time of this recording, you know, things change. So just know that this is the first episode of EB5 Investment Voice of 2019, but we know the topics that we're going to be sharing today are going to be good this month, next month, throughout 2019, and I would say probably in perpetuity. So we're going to focus on that evergreen type knowledge, vice exactly what is happening now and today.
in a way, Mark, because what we are discussing about some of the changes in the EB5 market right now, mm-hmm. and that's really connected with who our guest is and what our guest is going to be speaking about.
You're absolutely right, Mona. There has been some changes in the EB5 market. So we'll talk a little bit about that now.
Well, I think the most important thing is that, unfortunately, we have lost China as one of the main participants in this program due to the backlog. As EB5 developers and projects really struggle to stay on track with their developments, they have been looking into different markets. And not only have they been looking into different markets, which we've discussed on many past episodes, but there's other changes. We are seeing less numbers coming from other markets, but different structures and different types of projects and different sizes in projects. And the other interesting thing is the lack of the agent. The whole Chinese agent scheme has gone out, which is also causing a change in numbers. But today, what I really wanted to discuss is how the inclusion of private equity has come into the whole EB5 market and how that is really making a difference also in the rates of the return for investors.
That sounds interesting. You know, Mona, what would be perfect if we had somebody that has a background in private equity, perhaps a long background in private equity, now moving into EB5. Do we have such a person in the room?
So yes, here we wave the magic wand, and we do have somebody on our show today, Mark, who has a lot of knowledge in this area. I'm delighted to introduce Nicholas Salzano from the National Realty Investment Advisors. Welcome, Nicholas.
Well, thanks for having me, folks. It's good to be here.
Great to have you.
Nick, well, it's such a mouthful, National Realty Investment Advisors. You're also known as NRIA. Mm-hmm. And you have been in this industry for a long time, but not the EB5 industry, in the private equity and project development industry.
Yes, that's correct. Since 2006, we've been involved with private equity, and we are very familiar with the development of projects where, of course, we have dozens and dozens of them and thousands of units over that period of time using private equity money and our own firm's money as we developed.
So what kind of projects are we talking about?
Well, we began in 2006 and we're a specialist in townhome developments.
To real estate.
And, of course, real estate. Yes, pardon me. These were developments that were done jointly with our many accredited investors. And we have currently a portfolio of $800 million of rental projects, rented townhomes in the city of Philadelphia, where we started 12 years ago. Since then, we have developed and grown into three other markets, northern New Jersey, which particularly is the Gold Coast facing Manhattan, Brooklyn, New York, and Palm Beach County and Palm Beach area in Florida, which is another very lively a hot real estate market.
Right. Well, you've moved into EB5. That's why you're here for on EB5 Voice. What we are really interested, Nick, is the fact that you are blending EB5 with private equity. And you're coming up with different numbers and very different type of projects from what we are used to seeing on the market.
Well, thanks. We have a very large base, I'd like to point out, of wonderful South Asian Indian clients that began to approach us and ask about whether we would get involved in EB5 funding over the course of the past year. And so, yes, we have blended now and added EB-5 financing and projects to our core curriculum, which has always been, you know, private equity and the building of private projects with private capital. And we're happy to welcome our family of investors. You know, we have over 600 accredited investors in our family, and many of them brought this concept to us, which is kind of how we started.
Well, you mentioned South Asian, and I started the show by talking about China. And I know China has got a lot of private equity, but have you always been in the South Asian market? Southeast Asian, is it the Indian market, or have you got private equity investors from everywhere?
Well, our accredited investors are from all around the world, and they are wealthy individuals and family offices and business owners, what have you. They range, but I have to say we have a predominant 50% customer base from South Asia and South Asian Indian in particular, and that have been a wonderful repeat clientele and friends of our firm for so many years. So we're completely diversified in all of our client investors. But
I can see that. And I think also with the rise of the Indian EB-5 investor, you know, your timing's almost impeccable to come into the EB-5 market right now.
Yeah, we have a very large demand, we think, an interest among our existing accredited investor base. Of course, they are, in many cases, referring friends and relatives from overseas that would want to participate in an EB-5 type of visa investment project.
Now, there are lots of advantages and disadvantages to private equity. And I know a lot of companies are looking at private equity because it is favorable because it allows you a little more freedom to your liquidity and as opposed to commercial or conventional financing. We have a variety of listeners, Nicholas. We have developers, we have investors, as well as practitioners who really need to understand how, or like to understand how a project is structured. Often, because private equity is so different from EB-5, I'm wondering, how are you structuring a project to have both EB-5 component and a private equity component?
Well, that's a very good question. Of course, our history is private equity and our own developments and projects with individual accredited investors and groups. And the private equity piece is a piece of equity that is put in a project, typically 20 or 25% of the capital stack of the project. It is typically a more expensive capital, but it's put in for those investors to, over time, obtain a much higher return than a bank interest rate, for example, on a construction loan. And that can typically be shooting for a 15 to 21% type of return for private equity.
Wow, that's very high.
Yes, it is.
Is that a guaranteed return?
No, the private equity investor understands that to obtain that upper level of return, that there is, you know, risk involved, and those are the targets of the project. They are very intelligent, high-level people, our clients, and so they want to know the numbers and how our capital stack works to achieve that. And so it's important that they become familiar with the fact that, you know, typically our construction bank will provide 65 or 75% of the cost of a project. The private equity piece will layer in 20 or 25% more. The firm itself will put in 10% of capital, or 5% if private equity goes to 30, goes a little higher. But we're going to have, you know, three layers. We're going to have the bank in the first position. We're going to have private equity in what amounts to a second position, and 25 or 30% of capital there. We're going to have the firm's money in at the top. But
and where would you put EB-5 in that whole capital stack?
Well, this is the exciting thing for EB-5. We're able to close projects, begin projects, begin the building and, you know, not only permitting, but building projects that we own in a very agile manner with private equity, the flexibility that private equity gives us. Once that project is owned and underway, we can refinance out the more expensive private equity money, put that money in another new project, and bring in EB-5 money and help our EB-5 clients get their visas. And we do like to help people, so we do like to have them come in and refinance out that more expensive money and obtain a mutual benefit there.
It's very interesting because a few years ago, even 2 or 3 years ago, we would have projects where up to 70% could be used from EB-5. But we're just not seeing the numbers come in anymore to be able to finance deals. And so with private equity, I suppose you are able to match it up. But how is the flow of money? Is it slow, fast, you know, and your documentation also? Do you have to have two PPMs, two separate types of PPMs for each project?
Well, yes, there are two separate private placement memoranda for each project. One would be for how we closed and purchased the project and began building it, which is with private equity money. And that is in the project first. And it gives our EB-5 investors the comfort and safety to know that they are merely refinancing out in a project that is closed, underway, and fully financed, including a bank.
But don't forget, EB-5 has to be at risk. Money has to be at risk.
Yes, and their money is at risk because, you know, there is always the risk that somehow, some way, you don't finish a project or couldn't finish a project or had impediments to the project even after starting construction. There is risk involved, and that is fully disclosed to not only private placement investors, but EB-5 private placement investors. But at least the EB-5 investor is comforted with the fact that the project's underway, it's financed, it's approved, it's got permits, and they're just refinancing out, frankly, more expensive money for a mutual benefit.
What's the typical size of your projects? Can you do private equity?
We like our projects in a sweet spot that range from $30 million of cost to about as much as $80 million of cost. They're not too big. They're not the mega billion-dollar projects where you need thousands of investors. And we think it's a sweet spot, a mid-rise sweet spot that allows us to sell out the building or rent the building very rapidly after building it. And that allows us to have a need for only a few EB-5 investors to pull out a portion of the private equity money. I want to be very clear. Our money and private equity money stays in every project.
Right.
And this is also a comfort, I think, to our new EB-5 investors that they know that we have a lot of skin in the game in every project and that we're fully committed to every project to finish it.
Mm. Well, I have a question here, though. If a project's closed, we can't use EB-5 because we really can't show the job creation. So where do you structure the EB-5 component if in that sort of scenario?
Well, remember, we are bringing the EB-5 money in very rapidly after closing to take out the private equity. So the mass amounts of contract jobs being created have not begun.
Yeah.
So it sounds like you have the funding to build these, it sounds like, rentable townhomes in Philadelphia, North New Jersey, and Palm Beach, Florida, which sounds lovely this time of year, middle of winter as we're recording. So these projects are $30 million to $80 million to build these rentable townhomes, and you come up with that money through your own firm, through the bank, and through private equity of about 15, 21%. With that lump sum of money, now you start to get permits in place, start to get the organizations and the people in the workforce ready to start working. And then it sounds like what you're doing is where you can find the right piece. You take EB-5 and you take out some of the, we'll say, the more expensive private equity and replace that with EB-5 before the work actually starts, right?
That is correct.
Okay. So I
would like to point out also that a lot of those projects are apartment buildings. So I didn't get that clearly out there, but many of them are mid-rise apartment buildings.
But the big thing is, they're apartment buildings or townhomes. It's not a typical real estate where let's put a bunch of people on the ground, we build something, and then we sell it, and then the money we make from selling, we pay back our investors or what have you. But in this case, it sounds like the firm is holding or maybe property management, but these are rented. So it sounds like you're still kind of holding on to them, not necessarily cashing out immediately. But in a way, you kind of are cashing out the people that gave the early money, the riskiest money up front,
yes,
and therefore they get the highest rate of return, the 15 to 21%. And then an EB-5 investor can come in, obviously a lower rate of return, but they get the immigration benefit because you get that money before essentially the shovels hit the ground
to make it.
Okay, thank you.
Yes,
that's absolutely correct. You got it, Mark.
and we are able to then redeploy that more expensive private equity money into a new project, which makes those investors happy and keeps them at a nice return level.
Exactly, because most Americans prefer to live indoors.
this is the flexibility that you have, Mark, by using private equity. You're not really bound by, you know, market shares and market forces, rather, or rules that you get in conventional banks. And obviously, there's full disclosure and everything, but it is really more the private placement memorandum which governs.
Well, I like what Nicholas has done here because he has this investable project, this value creation, and he's he's obviously rewarded the early private equity investors handsomely for their early and perhaps riskiest money. And then he's found when he's eliminated some of the risk, obviously some of the risk is there, before the construction starts, because you need to create jobs, Nicholas has identified, wait a minute, perhaps EB-5 is a good component to put in here so we can, you know, not just pay some of the private equity back, but as he said, take it on to the next project so they can do more of these $30 to $80 million projects back to back to back, because they
These are smaller projects from what we're used to, Mark. If you recall, we've been discussing some mega projects where the EB-5 component itself was maybe $150 million just coming in through EB-5. So It is a much smaller, and what we are seeing on the market, and most investors who are coming in now are preferring this size. But Nick, you mentioned earlier that your interest rate, albeit a little lower for EB-5, is there. You are still giving, I think, a higher rate of interest on your projects than we are seeing in other projects. How are you affording this?
Well, yeah, that is correct. Our methodology as a fully vertically integrated developer cuts out many layers of, I'll call it, fat or extra cost in the project, because we are beginning with the locating and finding of raw land, or the demolition of a building that is going to lead us to raw land. We are entitling that building with all of its zoning and permit requirements. We are custom working with an exclusive group of brokers where we have whittled down their fees and finding fees and getting real estate for us to a minimum, because they have a lot of volume with us and repeat purchases. And we do that with the attorneys that close the projects, the title company that closes the project, and most importantly, our builders that we bid these to. We frankly beat them up very hard to make sure that we have extremely low-cost estimating confirmed building and construction fees and materials costs. And we value engineer that project as well with our architects to make sure that the building is properly designed and is going to be very efficient, extremely value-oriented and desirable to our purchasing or renting communities, but in fact, value engineered so that it can be built economically. So we cut out every layer of extra cost and fat in the project, from the creation, the location of the land, to the entitlement of the land, through the closing, financing, building, architecting, designing, and then ultimately we control the rental and resale process.
And then, of course, the investor does reap the benefit of having, as you're saying, less fat, because they can have a higher rate of interest.
Well, Nicholas, thank you for explaining your vertical integration and how you've managed to identify and eliminate some financial waste. But you know, I think Mona's question really is about what you're typically paying the EB-5 investors. Now, I know typically in this market, we see about, you know, 0.5% return on some of these investments because they're getting this immigration benefit. But I think what she was leading to is you don't pay 0.5%. You typically pay more because of the financial waste that you're eliminating, right?
Yes, that's correct. In all candor, our private equity investors get higher returns, and we felt it was only fair and appropriate to pay out the highest possible return we could to EB-5 investors. We don't need them in the project. The project is already closed. It's already funded. It's nice to have them in the project, and it's helpful, but we think it's fair to pay out a higher return because we're used to it in our private equity multiples. The last part of that, besides vertical integration,
I'm
going to
let you get off that easy. So I agree, it's fair. I mean, obviously, you're paying your private equity people 15 to 21%. It sounds like you're not paying that, but you're paying more than the 0.5%. Could you give us a range of what you typically pay out for the EB-5?
Well, yes, we start our projects with a 3% expected return to the EB-5 investor, and once they have obtained their permanent green card, we jump that to 6% until we cash them out of the project.
See, I wanted to highlight that because those are big numbers.
Mark, this is important for people who are coming from those countries where there's backlog. Even if we're talking about 2 to 3 years or 4 years, and then, of course, all the adjudication delays, very typically we are seeing, I mean, we've been in this business now 12 to 13 years, and we have seen many an investor, even if they are not from a country where there is a backlog, but their investment has been tied up for 7 to 8 years. if you are getting 0.5%, that's really dead money. Mm-hmm. But if I was an investor and I had an option of getting 6%, that is a very decent amount, even just to put aside for 6 to 8 years. So I think that is definitely something which other projects are starting to look at. And what we are seeing is that there are less projects with 0.5% and more projects trying to come up and have 2 or 3%. We haven't seen many projects at 6%, I can say that much.
Right. I agree, Mona. It sounds like a win-win because obviously the private equity investors, the first one to put in money, they're getting the biggest share, 15 to 21%. And then we bring in EB-5 money, originally at 3%. I can go up to 6%, take out some of that private equity money of that first project, and then put some of that private equity money into another project. And I can kind of see why, and Nicholas, I agree with you. It sounds fair. You're paying your private equity people so much, so let's pay the EB-5 people. But in a business case, this makes sense because you want to keep going. I mean, these are, as Mona said, these aren't the big projects that we typically see, the $150 million resort properties. These are, you're quickly identifying properties and demo and zoning and permits and more places to build these properties. So the faster you can keep doing this, the more everyone wins. So yeah, it sounds like a complete win scenario.
I have a question here, though. We have discussed on many a podcast and really on many a panel the differences between urban and rural type of projects. What we have seen in our own practice is that there is a huge difference with the mathematics because something is urban and because something is rural. This is going to be a big deal moving forward as we hopefully this year brings the changes in EB-5, the TEA changes, opportunity zones, etc. We are going to see more projects in the rural side, which are going to be at a lower investment level. So my question to you here, Nicholas, is because you cut the fat out, have you considered doing your projects in a more rural area? Does that make even more of a difference? Why do you choose the locations you choose?
We choose a prime downtown urban real estate because it is extremely safe. It is extremely in high demand extremely demanded by the public. And we know how to negotiate its price down. It's not easy dealing with the sellers of that type of land, but we are able to, through a very sophisticated negotiation and process with our professionals, explain to people what can really be built there and what their property is really worth. And sometimes even partner with them in the deal to make sure that we get a fair price for the land. So we begin with a fair price for the land. We make sure we have a low cost of value engineered build. And those two massive costs in the project are very advantageous for us because we've really brought them to the lowest possible levels every time. There's one last thing that should be understood also, though, besides being vertically integrated, cutting out all of the fat, bringing in private equity money to close and control a project rapidly, and being able to redeploy that money. Remember, our capital stack comes from our head of finance, Coley O'Brien from Wall Street, very, very bright guy and friend. That allows us to pay our private investors in our property fund these high rates of return because we have the bank in it, 65 or 75%. We've got a private equity layer that is limited and does not have an unlimited upside. So one of the important things to understand how we structure our private equity when we bring it in is those investors have a target return of 15 to 21%, 16 to 21% typically, but they're capped at 21%. They don't have an unlimited upside. All of the upside above those types of annualized rates of returns in a project come to us at the corporate level, controlling many, many projects through the fund. And what happens is when you really look at how much money we put in with our private equity fund versus our partner's private equity fund that comes into the project, you will see that our 10 or 15 or 20% of the capital in is controlling 70% of the cash flow out of all of our projects. So if you only have to put in 10 or 15% of the money, but you get 70% of the cash flow out of the project, and this is happening over a relatively short duration of 36 months, 40 months, 28 months, hey, I'll put in 10% all day long and get 70% sent out of the cash flow of a project all day long.
But Nicholas, you're not answering the question about the urban side versus rural. Mm-hmm. So if we take the same project and put it in a, say, a popular rural area, surely your costs are even lower.
Well, it is true that the Opportunity Zone legislation is oriented to more rural areas. And there are projects available outside of the big cities and the high demand centers that are cheaper. We just don't believe in them. We don't like them because I don't like risk. And we don't like our customers taking risk. And I know when we get and focus on, and we're still able to get prime downtown real estate. We haven't given up on that.
So you're saying that urban is less risky than rural?
Urban is 10 times less risky than any rural project. And it's more expensive, but you know, rule number one, don't lose money.
Yeah, and it sounds like Nicholas really understands that market. Plus, it sounds like he understands his investors. As he mentioned before, about 600 investors, about 800 million invested. So that's a little over a million, say 1.3 million each. So they know what they want, and they also... It sounds like they came to him with EB-5. He was talking about earlier,
yes.
You know, the South Asia, the Indian clients were saying, hey, what about EB-5? You're doing such a great job here. Could you somehow structure EB-5 in this? But, you know,
that's exactly how they did come into EB-5. Mm-hmm. Isn't that right?
Yes.
So, yeah, that's what I was trying to explain earlier. We are seeing EB-5 practitioners moving, EB-5 developers rather, moving towards private equity. And here we have private equity, which is taking on EB-5. So it is a difference. Nicholas, as you are primarily a private equity firm, I understand that the primary source of revenue for private equity firms is a management fee. Is that how you guys make money?
Yes. Well, we make a development fee on every real estate project that we do. It's in all of our disclosures. It can range from $500,000 to a few million dollars, depending on the size of the project. But we do and properly get a development management fee to take that property from raw land at 0 miles per hour to 3 years later, a 100-mile-per-hour fully built project.
So that's a difference. That is a difference in the way it is structured and handled from your typical conventional financing real estate.
Yeah, I would say so. Our investors have 100% of their money put into the real estate project. From the project, we have our fees paid, you know, by our banks and from the closing of the project. And 100% of the capital raised in every private placement goes into the real estate. But we do get a fair and honest property management fee to take the project development fee from raw land through its entitlements, through its build and rent, rented status.
Right. And not to mention, Nicholas, your surplus over the cap. So if the internal rate of return of the project is greater than 21%. The investor, they're getting up to 21%, but you take that surplus over the stack, as I heard earlier. Is that correct?
Yes, that is absolutely.
Is that the greatest portion of essentially the revenue generated for the firm?
Far and away. Yeah,
that's what I thought. Okay.
Far and away. You know, management fees get you through the three-year project to get it to a sellable state and a cash-flowing rental state.
I see.
Most of our projects are apartment buildings these days. So, yes, you're absolutely correct.
Management fees basically keep the lights on, keep the secretaries at their desk, and then at the end of the year, that's when you show everything else. Okay, thank you.
Mark, we did a little research on this, and we found out that some firms charge around about a 2% management fee on managed assets, but require 20% of the profits. So,
yeah, it sounds like what we're hearing from Nicholas and NRIA is they're extremely motivated to increase the internal rate of return over the cap. So the investors are happy, they're hitting their cap, and obviously they're getting the surplus of the cap, which is the lion's share of what they make.
Yes. And also, our investors are always paid first. Our money goes down on a project and in a project first, and we're the last ones to get our money out and to get paid last. So we're the last part of the pecking order to get paid.
And that's why you have those management fees, just so your basic staff and everything can at least operate.
Correct.
So that makes sense. Okay. All right. Thank you.
It's certainly enlightening, right, Mark?
It is. And I can certainly see why EB-5 investors would be interested in something like this, because there's a proven track record. As I said earlier, most Americans prefer to live indoors, even if that means renting a townhome or apartment. Nicholas has experience in doing this for like 13 years, and his clients are telling him to go into EB-5. He didn't find this because he needed the money. His clients are saying, hey, can we invest and also do EB-5? And he's found how to do that, you know, by obviously lowering the return, but doing it before shovels hit the ground, everything. It makes a lot of sense. As well as investors should look at private equity and how they could stack that. Well, Nicholas Salzano, thank you so much for bringing your experience from the National Realty Investment Advisors here to EB5 Investment Voice.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you, Mark and Mona.
Thank you.
Thank you for being with us today on EB5 Investment Voice. The topics presented in this podcast is informational in nature and is not to be taken as specific legal advice. If you have questions on the topics presented in this episode or other investment immigration needs, please contact Mona Shaw & Associates. Mona and her attorney staff can be reached at mshawlaw.com. That's mshahlaw.com. Make sure you don't miss our next episode focusing on a different aspect of the EB5 program by subscribing to the podcast. While you're at it, leave us a rating on iTunes. If you really found this episode valuable, share it with someone else that could benefit from this information. Until then, I'll see you on the next episode of EB5 Investment Voice.